knows that she goes, she's on mission control. That she hovered around in her own little world.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the fourth installment of the DavidBix.com podcast. I am David Bixenspan, and I am joined here today by the author of Hardcore History, the extremely unauthorized story of ECW, as well as the co-author of Terry Funk, More Than Just Hardcore, and The Cowboy and the Cross, the Bill Watts story. I am joined by Scott Williams. How you doing, Scott?
David, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Had a lot of rain and wind here in New York, but it's better. How's it down in Texas?
Well, you know, after about 6 months of blinding hot summer, it looks like we're in for our 2 weeks of fall, which is usually followed by our 2 weeks of winter, and then it's summer again. But it finally cooled off.
Oh, that's good. That's good. So, oh, also forgot to mention that you are also the crime reporter and pop culture columnist for the Galveston Daily News in Galveston, Texas.
That's right. Until about 6 weeks ago, had done a weekly wrestling column in the sports section, and a number of factors kind of came to a head. I decided to end the wrestling column. And the pitch that I made was that, you know, we can put something instead on the lifestyle page. It was kind of a niche that we weren't really filling of doing just a straight pop culture column. We can talk about anything from video games to computer downloads, music and TV and movies. Covers a lot more ground. And, you know, if anything does happen within the wrestling world that merits significant coverage, well, that falls under pop culture, too, and we can throw it in there.
But right now, nothing really to write about for a weekly newspaper column on wrestling.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like. The next thing that the sports editors, and not just in my paper, but the thing the sports people and newspapers around the country are starting to have to figure out is how they're going to cover MMA. Because a lot of them have been covering boxing forever, but there are pockets and demographics where MMA has got more popularity than that.
Wow. So being a mid-sized newspaper, I guess that's the best way to describe it, mid-sized, not super huge, but pretty big, right?
It's probably on the smaller end of the mid-sized market scale.
Would it be easier to nudge something like MMA in since...
You know, if anything, I think it's harder because the smaller community papers put so much focus on high school sports. It's such a higher percentage than it is for, you know, say the New York Times or even the Houston Chronicle in our part of the north of me. They have more flexibility, you know, because they can do more things with more pro sports. But the smaller community papers are so tied into that community spirit. And a big part of that ends up being the high school sports. And so I think, if anything, it's tougher to wedge something new in.
Especially in Texas with high school sports.
Oh, man, football season, you're not kidding. You know, within our coverage area, we have something like 15 high schools. And each and every one of them has a sizable following of people who care how that football team is doing.
Here on Long Island, it's not as big a deal, but, you know, so, and we got, like, you know, a ton of newspapers, because also we got the major New York papers, and then we got the Long Island papers, but anyway, back to wrestling. How did you first get into wrestling, I guess, would be the best way to start this?
And I guess I was just flipping channels in either late 82 or early 83. I can tell you the first wrestling show that I saw, which was right when Paul Bosch, the Houston promoter, had thrown in with Bill Watts of Mid-South Sports. Bosch had been promoting shows in conjunction with Joe Blanchard's group, the Southwest, that ran out of San Antonio. And he ended up switching his allegiance to Watts. There were some problems with some of the key pieces of talent in Blanchard's group. And I think Bosch saw that there was more money to be made with the Mid-South, because they had brought in Junkyard Dog just kind of as a one-off, and he was a great draw for Bosch a couple of times. And I think Bosch took a long look at the two groups and decided that Watts' group was the better way to go. So the first show that I saw was the first one, I think it was the first one that Bosch did in conjunction with Bill Watts and Mid-South. And it was the episode where the Junkyard Dog and Mr. Olympia lose the tag titles with Dog having to leave town in the match against DiBiase and Matt Bourne, where Hacksaw Duggan turns out to be the guy in the gorilla suit.
And that led to Stagger Lee.
Yep. So, you know, you turn on this show, I had never seen wrestling before, but you turn on this show, and there it is, just the weirdest spectacle that you could think of, and I guess in a sense I was fortunate that the one that I started out on was one where they just did one of the wildest angles ever, because it definitely caught my attention.
I can't remember which Stagger Lee was first, Coco Ware or JYD?
JYD. It was actually based on the idea of the babyface losing under controversial circumstances and returning under a mask was something that I don't think the original idea was with Stagger Lee and the Junkyard Dog. Although it might have been. I know Dusty Rhodes left and did the Uvalde Slim gimmick, but I think he was a heel when he did that.
I think he was a face by then. Because, you know what? We'll keep going, but meanwhile, I'll check the CWF archives to get the time period on that. So, anyway, that caught your attention, and about how old were you then?
12 or 13.
And you just got hooked from there?
Yep. And that's what got me rolling on it.
When did you start going to live shows at the Sam Houston Coliseum?
The first one that I ever went to was February 24th, 1984. My dad was pretty vociferously against going to the wrestling matches. But there was this new act, this heel team, and the manager was so completely obnoxious that the stipulations for the show that night were that if his team lost, he'd get lashed 5 times with a belt. And more than anything, I wanted to see someone beat the hell out of Jim Cornette. Mm-hmm. And so the prospect of getting to see him whipped brought me to my first show where, of course, nobody went home happy on that match because the Midnight Express beat Magnum TA and Mr. Wrestling number 2. But that was my first taste of going to a live show.
How wild were the crowds in Houston compared to the other crowds on the Watts circuit? Were they a little more reserved?
I think a little bit, but just all that means is that they weren't pulling out weapons on the preliminary guys.
Yeah.
I mean, they would throw stuff, try to run in the ring. I got to where I was a big Steve Dr. Death Williams fan, and they did an angle where Dr. Death took the TV title medal away from Crusher Khrushchev, and everybody thought it was a great thing. So then Terry Taylor beats Crusher Khrushchev for the title, and I guess you can see where this is heading. Mm-hmm. Taylor says, great, hey, this is fantastic. I finally beat the evil Russian turncoat, and now that I'm the champ, Doc, I'd like my medal back. And Doc, after a couple of weeks of stalling, ends up telling him, I'll tell you what, I'll tell you the same thing I told Khrushchev. You want it, come beat me for it. And eventually, and Watts, well, I asked Watts about this, and he did not remember why they did what they did with this. Eventually, what happened was Mid-South just ordered Dr. Death to turn over the medal to Taylor. And to me, I thought Dr. Death was right. I mean, if it was okay for him to take the medal from Khrushchev and keep it, well, what made Terry Taylor so special?
Right.
And that was the point at which I rooted for my first heel. And it was a long time before I ever cheered. In fact, I didn't cheer again for Terry Taylor until he turned heel, which was about three years after that.
Okay, I'm looking at the CWF archive site. Valdi Slim was a babyface.
Okay, then that was the first one. Well, Watts in his book talks about, let me rephrase, that's the first one I'm aware of. Very well could have been another one somewhere.
The most famous one.
But yeah, that was probably the first one that got a lot of notoriety and did a lot of business. And, you know, in the book, Watts talks about, hell, we cribbed ideas from each other all the time. Dusty ended up cribbing the Midnight Rider angle from the way that we did the Stagger Lee. And then later I ended up copying the Midnight Rider angle from Dusty. Which is, of course, something that you can't really have now, but when they had all the different regions and no one was nationwide except for that TBS show, someone could do an angle in Florida and then be talking to their buddy who ran Oklahoma and say, oh, you should see this. We did this great gimmick. And then they do it in Oklahoma because the people in Oklahoma didn't know they did it in Florida.
Now, I guess that you would have started watching just after the time where cable was starting to really disrupt things. Like, I know the story that Dave Meltzer always tells all the time about Terry Funk being, you know, the big tough babyface fan of the friend of the Mexicans in Amarillo, while he's the big racist anti-Mexican heel on Los Angeles TV, which was on Spanish International Network.
That's true, and he was so strong a heel on that California show that it started to crib Amarillo's business. And Terry never, ever forgot that. And when he saw Tommy Rich on TBS in, I guess, 79, he remembered his experience. And he knew that that the advent of this nationwide cable television meant a couple of things for the wrestling business. The first thing that it meant was that the idea of being able to send a tired piece of talent somewhere else was not going to always be an option. And I think that him selling, and it must have been 78 that he saw TBS, because the TBS and him seeing nationwide wrestling was the thing that prompted him to want to sell his stake in the Amarillo territory. And I think Dory agreed with him because they sold the Murdoch and Mulligan in pretty short order. And they warned him too. They said, you know, we think the way this business is going, this is not going to be a good way to go for you guys. So we're willing to sell it to you, but you need to understand what you're getting yourself into. And Murdoch and Mulligan didn't see the trend coming that the Funks had seen. And so they ended up kind of succumbing to it, because that's exactly what got them.
Okay. So I guess I'm trying to figure out, where do I skip ahead to next? When did you start writing about wrestling?
I actually wrote my first interview or piece on wrestling for my high school newspaper in 1986, when I went and interviewed Paul Bosch, who was really just one of the great people in the wrestling business. There's no way anybody could, he was so just friendly, forthcoming, and accommodating. And I guess that combined with we had a columnist in Houston, in Ken Hoffman, who wrote kind of a leisure column that he still writes now. At the time, he wrote for the Houston Post, and he would occasionally put little snippets about wrestling in there. And I guess it was the enjoyment that I got out of doing the Paul Bosch piece, combined with my enjoyment of reading Hoffman stuff, that got me thinking that wrestling writing was something that was viable. That certainly, like much else in our business of journalism, you're never going to get rich doing, but you could at least dabble in it and have some fun with it.
Did you ever talk to Paul Bosch about Ken Hoffman after the deal where Hoffman printed in his column that there was no way Jake Roberts would win the North American title from Dick Slater because he was going to the WWF, so they switched the title?
You know what? At the time, I didn't even know about that situation. It so happened that the weekend that happened, I was out of town. And it wasn't until, I guess, I first met Hoffman in late 87. And it was maybe a year and a half after that he showed me the tape of that interview where bloody Jake Roberts has the belt and he reads from Ken Hoffman's column. And so I never even knew about that when I went to talk to Bosch. But Hoffman, to this day, will proudly tell you that that was the moment he changed wrestling history.
Now, where did you go from there as far as moving on with wrestling writing?
Well, I guess I really didn't come back to it until I ended up going into the service and then went to college. And I didn't really do much with writing about wrestling. Well, I'd write an occasional column here or there, just kind of a general interest piece about it. But during those years, it was the early to mid-90s when, until Nitro really took off, wrestling was in one of its real slumps of popularity. And it wasn't until, I guess, 98 that it was really seeming to click on all cylinders. You know, the WWF was coming up in a big way after sucking wind for a couple of years, thanks to the Nitro concept. But Nitro at the time was still doing great business, and WWF and Raw were doing great business, or starting to, when they launched the Austin McMahon program. And I guess I had the idea in my head that we could do this. And then in 99, I went to my editor at the Galveston County Daily News and pitched him the idea of doing a weekly wrestling column in the sports section. And I guess he believed enough in what I was telling him and what my arguments were about that there's an audience for it that's more sizable than there is for some sports we're already covering. You know, like being in Southeast Texas and having small articles about hockey.
Right.
Which I'm sure is a much bigger deal to you up there than it is down here.
Yep, I'm right in the heart of Islanders country, but go ahead.
Exactly. And so we went with that, and we started the wrestling column in January of 99, and until about 6-7 weeks ago, never looked back from that. Just went through that whole period. And what got it to the end, well, there were a couple of factors that brought it to the end. One was I just wasn't enjoying watching it anymore. And there comes a point where you have to keep up with it to a certain degree to really be able to provide any kind of column or coverage, to be able to speak with any kind of informed voice. Mm-hmm. And if you're not doing that, then you're really doing a disservice for the people who read that, because they're expecting someone who knows what they're talking about. And I was reaching the point where I just was having a hard time making myself keep up enough with the current product to know what I was talking about. And the other thing was not even from a quality standpoint, but remember a few minutes ago I said one of my big arguments for starting the column was that in 1999 wrestling was more popular than a lot of sports we were giving coverage to. But you fast forward 7.5 years, and not only is wrestling having lost significant popularity, but sports sections in newspapers across the country are getting smaller and smaller, and spaces getting tighter and tighter. And everything that's in those sections has to fight harder to justify its existence. And that being the case, I just didn't think that wrestling could justify its existence in the pages of that paper anymore. Because the popularity that was a major factor for putting it in the first place, it wasn't there anymore.
Now, when you started the column, were you just doing the crime reporting, or were you doing anything else there?
No, I was just doing crime and courts. I think during the time that I did that column, there's a handful of wrestling columnists across the country. Alex Marvez is the first one who comes to mind, but there's a few more of them. I think I was the only one of those who wasn't a sports guy the rest of the time. I was a straight news guy. And I guess fortunately or unfortunately, my particular area of coverage and expertise lend itself pretty well to covering wrestling more than once.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, I just have a lot more experience talking to people who work at morgues than most people who wrote wrestling columns. And so that, you know, unfortunately that did come in handy a few times.
Now, what was the hardest thing to write about then? Was it when you would end up calling morgues after someone after a wrestler's death and coroner's reports, or were you just so used to it at that point that
I think because my day-to-day, I it was a lot easier for me to write those pieces than it was for, say, Meltzer. The other reason it wasn't as hard for me as it is for Meltzer to write those pieces is that a lot of those guys who die, and particularly like a Brian Pillman. Brian Pillman wasn't just a guy that Meltzer covered. That was a pretty good friend of his.
Same with Eddie Guerrero, Chris Candido.
Yep, and the, you know, so there's a personal element that's there with him that was hardly ever there with me. And I guess I'm sorry.
No, I was gonna. You go ahead.
I guess the ones that were the hardest to write were the last couple of months before I gave it up, because I was having to flip through shows, figure out what was going on, what the trends were, and what clicked with me enough to write about. Because if the thing of writing about is not clicking to you, it shows, and people can pick that up when they read it.
As long as we're talking about it, Dave, what exactly is your role in the production of The Observer? I know you, and I don't even know exactly what it is.
I do some proofreading and help him reaching out to, like, some... When he has, like, a law enforcement or a legal-type question, I can track stuff down. I'll help him find some court records if there's a case he needs. They say I proofread some, but not all of the issue every week. Just kind of miscellaneous and sundry tasks.
Is it more of a proofreading for facts or for grammar?
Both.
I shouldn't make the obvious joke, should I?
Now, the thing about what he does is if I stop and think about it, And I'm pretty productive as reporters go. I write an average of 10 stories a week. And my 10 stories a week usually total a grand whopping 5,000 words. So I'm producing about 5,000 words a week for my paper, which is a lot for a single reporter to do. Meltzer produces 20,000 to 30,000 words a week. And, you know, inevitably that there's going to be stuff that slips through, even if he proofreads his own stuff. I think anybody who writes knows that when you write something, you are never, ever the best proofreader you can get.
Yeah, I don't fault him for it, because as you said, he's writing a hell of a lot for the week. I just didn't realize at one point that anyone, much less you, were proofreading for him. And I was like, wait, he has someone proofreading it? But... Yeah. I'm not blaming you either. It's a hell of a lot to go through. Now, are you doing this like when he's putting the issue to bed on late Thursday night, or what?
No,
or
usually
do you do chunks over the week.
Usually, it works. We'll start Sunday evening with whatever he has to that point, and I'll get a start on it like that. A lot of times, it just depends on whatever the rest of my schedule is, and when he and I can connect on the phone, and we fax papers back and forth. And that's probably the main reason that I don't proof more of it than I do, is just because a lot of times I can't match up my schedule with what he's doing, because I still have crimes and courts to keep up with.
I want to ask you one more thing about the more day-to-day stuff before I get to the books.
Sure.
What sort of response did you get to that Kurt Angle column a couple months ago, which... I thought was fantastic, and I know a lot of people did, but some people took offense to the term sweaty man boys.
Yeah, a lot of the sweaty man boys did not like being called sweaty man boys. That was my general impression of the response that I got. The column, for I'm sure most of the people listening to this did not read it, was, and it's more a reflection on the popularity of my column, not the informed nature of your listeners. But it was mainly about how fan expectation of spectacular matches combined with fan appetites for the way certain wrestlers are supposed to look are as responsible for the trail of broken and dead bodies as the wrestlers themselves or as Vince McMahon or whoever else is promoting them. I mean, wrestling more than any other sport is fan-supported. You know, you look around football and baseball and basketball, your major franchises are playing in arenas that are funded by taxpayer dollars that they get all this luxury box and parking money from. There's a lot of ancillary revenue connected to those major sports. With wrestling, pretty much the entire money that the company makes comes from those fans. And so fans who support a business when they know that the way it's being run is killing the guys doing it, and they continue to support it, well, I'm sorry, but they're part of the problem. And that's basically what I wrote in the column, and I got a lot of offended response. And I tend to think that the people who took offense to that were exactly the people I was talking about.
Yeah, for me, it wasn't as much, you know, before Kurt Angle got fired, I was, you know, I certainly thought he was in awful, you know, shape, but, you know, I wasn't necessarily slighting people for, you know, wanting to see him wrestle, but then as soon as he gets released, even though really before anyone even reported anything about drugs or anything, it should have been obvious that was why he was gone. And the first thing you see is people saying that they want to see him wrestle Samoa Joe or American Dragon.
Right. And you know, the idea that that is the first response indicates that that's where people's priorities are. I mean, your first response to that news, that stop and think about how screwed up an individual must be for Vince McMahon to go, you know, it's just not healthy, Kurt. We're going to have to let you go. I mean, Kurt was one of Vince McMahon's big draws. Mm-hmm. And for McMahon to be willing to let him go, if you consider how important it has been to him to draw whatever he can draw with whoever he can draw with, to the point that he has hired Eric Bischoff to come work for him. The fact that he's letting go a wrestler who clearly still has some monetary value is pretty telling.
And then it was one thing that people would not, you know, get it from the just hearing the news. Okay, that's fine, whatever. But then when, you know, I get it, not a ton of people read the actual print Observer, but when you've got people on message boards trying to explain it to you that Kurt Angle is being carted around by guys they hired to handle him so he wouldn't get lost on the way to the arena, and you just dismiss that because it wasn't some first-hand account or whatever, then I don't know.
In wrestling,
you go ahead.
Fandom, as in a lot, I mean, this isn't unique to wrestling fandom, but there are a lot of people who start out with the position that they believe in, and then they process other facts and input only to the degree that they support the conclusion they've already reached, instead of starting out maybe with an opinion, but at least with enough of an open mind that you can consider other information. And I think there's a lot of willful blindness among that fan community. And, you know, certainly none of that is to excuse Kurt Angle for what he does to himself, because ultimately he's the one who's going to bear the consequences of it. And as a grown-up, he certainly bears responsibility for what he does. But I still think that contributing to a structure like that you know is causing bad health makes you part of the problem.
Now, was most of the response that you got to the column from just various people who read it online or from people in the area?
Most of it was online.
Yeah, because actually I think that one Dave ended up posting on his website.
Yeah, he ended up running probably about three-quarters of the ones that I did from 2003 on. The ones that he didn't run were ones that I never sent him, which were columns that pretty much dealt with an area show or a local wrestler or one of the little indies that runs around here, to where I just didn't think there'd be enough interest in the wider Observer readership.
Now, I guess next topic is the books, and to get started with that, how'd you get hooked up with Terry Funk to write his book with him?
Believe it or not, that was Meltzer. Terry had wanted Dave Meltzer to co-author his book, and Sports Publishing contacted Dave and pitched him the idea of doing it. And Dave's response, at the time, Dave was in the finishing touches of Tributes 2, and also for Sports Publishing, and his answer to them was, look, I'm neck deep in newsletter work, and you guys already have me working on another book. I tell Terry I just don't have time to do it. And then he said, but you know what? I do know this guy in Texas who's really good. And so that's how they ended up calling me on it. What they didn't know, and I had to get cleared through both sides, was that I had already begun the process of talking to Bill Watts about doing his life story, and had worked with ECW Press to come up with a concept for his book and a way to make that go. And I actually got the things put together to do those books probably within a week of each other in early 2004. So even though, and a lot of people don't realize this because the Watts book came out months after the Terry Funk book did, but I was actually doing, I'd come home from work and do 1,000 words on each book at night.
Originally, they were supposed to just come out a couple months apart, but the Watts book got delayed about at least 6 months, wasn't it?
Yeah, and there were some editing concerns and just some content things where there were some points that Mr. Watts wanted to make sure that we made, and just some, it wasn't really a disagreement, just we were just kind of haggling out what was going to go where, and hearing the editor voice, you know, their concerns on the publishing side, and you know, it all got worked out. But those delays, you know, and the little ones can stack up a lot of time quickly in the publishing world. You don't realize how much two or three paragraphs that you have to figure out are going to make a 30-day difference in publication, but they do.
Now, was that just an editing matter then, the delay of the Watts book?
It was.
Because I knew you had finished it.
I'm
you
sorry?
Had finished it because I remember you had finished it a good while before it came out.
Yeah, I had finished it on my end, and there was a lot of trimming that had to be done. The thing about Mr. Watts is that if anybody's ever heard him speak, he's a very detailed storyteller, and that's not a bad thing. It's just that his recall is so sharp, and he knows so many details about his stories that by the time you get to the end of the book of his life story, it's become too much to fit into. I mean, we could have put the book out probably a lot closer to the way that it looked initially, but it would have cost $50.
Speaking of sharp memories, Terry Funk, for a guy who's getting along in the years, and has certainly taken a lot of knocks to the head, he sure has a hell of a memory, because should I tell my story?
Yeah, I'll tell your story.
Okay, I'm sure you're familiar with it.
Yeah, I've heard it. The one I think it is.
Yes. There's a radio show host named John Arezzi, who ran some fan conventions in the early 90s here in New York. And at one of them, I met Terry Funk and got his autograph and stuff. And being a precocious youngster and being all wacky, Terry Funk signed it, "Stay Out of Jail, Terry Funk." Which I heard he did to other people as well, but whatever. So, flash ahead, I believe this was 10 years, I think it was 10 years later, I'm at a Jersey All-Pro show with Terry Funk against Jerry Lawler, and Terry Funk's coming out from the back, walking along the back wall by the back row where I am, and just shaking hands with people and stuff. And he, you know, shake hands with him, and then he stops for a second, turns back, looks at me and says, "So did you stay out of jail?" I was floored. That's special.
Yeah, it is. And you know, there were some things where Terry does have some trouble recalling dates on things. And so we did have to sort some of that stuff out. And there was one that I think remained in there that I've gotten to the point where I pretty well accept that this is just an error, but Terry swears and maintains that this happened the way that he said it happened. The famous arm cutting in Japan, he had as a solo match that happened in 81 as opposed to the tag league match in 77. And so, you know, that's probably the most blatant example, but you know, there were some things about dates, but other than that, you're right. I mean, he remembers details and personalities. He's got a great memory for people.
Man, because I would just say, how does he even remember that? I was just one fan, you know? It wasn't particularly notable yet.
Well, you know? I don't know that I'd agree with that either. That arm cutting angle was...
No, I'm talking about me.
Oh, okay.
No, the arm cutting angle was a big deal. I'm talking about me. I'm saying that's not particularly notable, and yet somehow after 10 years, he recognizes me. Then later, I'm getting him to sign this old Japan program I had, and he apologizes for not remembering my name.
Yeah, that sounds like Terry.
He's one of a kind. One of a kind. And so, what exactly is an interview process like for these books?
Well, I went in with I researched the various periods of the two men's lives, mm-hmm. and asked a series of questions. And I think the thing to do for anybody who's doing these things is to, instead of asking a ton of really specific questions to start with a bunch of open-ended questions. That's what I did. Mm-hmm. Because that lends itself more to these guys telling stories, which is what you want. You don't want a rapid fire Q&A, you know, you want a little bit of question and then a lot of answer, because that's where they fill in the color and the personalities. And a lot of times those stories would go in directions that my original question had not even intended. There was, you know, I had one question about dealing with the talent in the locker room when Bill Watts was in the WWF in 1995. Which he talked about, and then it led him into this story about how Shawn Michaels had pissed off, of all people, Bob Backlund, one of the nicest people ever in wrestling, to the point that the Backlund was ready to tear him apart in the dressing room, and Watts took Backlund aside, and he said, Bob, come on. You're going to throw away your whole relationship with Vince. Over what? Over beating up Shawn Michaels? That's like beating up some pussy on the street. See, and if I had kind of demanded control of the interview, which a lot of interviewers do, and some interviews call for that, but in that situation, I never would have gotten that story. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of times these guys remember stuff that they haven't thought about in years. And so you just kind of have to let them go. And I would come back with more specific questions if there was a part that we needed to flesh out from the general questions. And then I would just throw out a bunch of names to do some name recognition with them. And with Terry in particular, it led to a lot of anecdotes that we wouldn't have had otherwise.
One thing I liked about the Terry Funk book in particular was the section where he's talking about cutting a promo and what you got to do. Where he prints also some of the transcripts from that last Jerry Lawler feud in Memphis, which I guess was about a year after that match I saw. But that's just some fantastic stuff. And, he, you know, Dave Meltzer says it a lot, it's almost a cliche, but Terry Funk really is a guy that just has the right mind for the wrestling business.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when the book came out, there were an awful lot of people who thought that Terry's prognostication about the rising emergence of mixed martial arts was just crazy talk. But flash forward 2 years, he doesn't sound quite as crazy right now, does he?
Nope.
But, you know, about the promo thing was something that he wanted to make a point of doing an educational piece on promo delivery. And the format that we ended up going with was he had just cut the promos for the Lawler feud where he goes back to Memphis and does the one shot with against Jerry Lawler. And so what we did was we framed how to do a promo around those four promos, because if you go back and watch them, there's different elements to each one that we can then flesh out and talk about in the passages that follow until you get to the end of the chapter and the end of the promos.
What did you think of Terry saying that he didn't actually believe that Jerry Lawler was, quote, a baby banger?
You know what? I kind of let that sit. Who am I to say?
That's probably for the best.
Right.
I just remember reading that, and you know, he just said, you know, I hadn't actually seen these promos, but you know, he's talking about, you know, I'm reading the transcript, and you know, blah blah blah, Jerry Lawler, bet you baby banger. And
see, and he used so that awful. when he and I were talking.
Yeah.
For the book. He had given that as an example, you know, like if I was going up against Jerry Lawler, I might call him a baby banger. And I put my pen down for a second. And I said, oh, come on, you wouldn't really say that. And he goes, see, that's exactly why you would say it. Because nobody would think that you would say that in a working atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. How awful is my Terry Funk, by the way?
That's actually pretty good. It's better than a lot of them. And believe me, I've heard a lot of them.
Actually, my friend Brian, who was on the show with Bob Barnett on Friday, actually did a very good one. He was telling me that he was trying to get, I mean, of course, a lot of people have probably heard this already if they listened to it on Friday, but telling me that at one point he was trying to get a Terry Funk record book done. So he was talking to Terry after, I forget who, I think Cornette gave him the phone number, and somehow Mike Lano comes up and he does this dead-on Terry Funk saying, you know, the whole show was basically about Lano, but as far as talking to Terry about him, he says, Mike Lano is crazy, or something like that.
Yeah, I met Mike Lano at the Cauliflower Alley last year.
Anything fun?
The less said, the better.
Okay. Yeah, I realize my Terry Funk is almost starting to sound like Dr. Phil.
You know who's always done a pretty good Terry Funk to the point that a lot of people don't realize that he's doing a Terry Funk is Cactus Jack.
Yes.
Those Cactus Jack promos where it's like that half moan, that Sting, I'm going to get you.
Yeah.
I mean, that's Terry Funk's cadence and tone and pitch.
Paulie did an awesome Terry Funk.
Who's that?
Paulie Dangerously. Paul Hammer.
Oh, yeah. Paulie does a great Terry Funk.
Actually, I remember, yeah, he does a, there's a episode of WCW Main Event right after the Wrestle War where Terry pile drives Flair, and he's doing this thing where he's talking about, first he's doing impressions of guys in WWF and knocking them, and there's one that I couldn't tell if it was supposed to be Savage or Hogan, where he does like a gruff voice, and it's not really specifically either one or the other, but he talks about their hair falling out. But then, and you know, I think he does a Piper, and then he says, but the greatest wrestler I've ever done an impression of is Terry Funk.
Yep. Paulie had a really good one, sometime in 91, I guess. He was doing the announcing, and Sting is coming out to do a match, and Paulie does a drop-dead perfect Ole Anderson as the Black Scorpion voice, and he goes, Sting, I'm back. And that's all he said.
Sting.
And I was just rolling.
Yeah. The Black Scorpion.
Well, you know, if a wrestling magician is not scary, then what is?
I don't know. Any random fun Terry Funk stories from the creation of the book? Either stuff he told you, stuff that just happened from while you're together, or just whatever. Stuff that didn't make in the book, what?
I'm trying to think. But no, I think everything we really wanted to get, we got.
Anything fun just from the process of making the book?
Oh, yeah. He's just it's not like he's always on, but he's always funny. And he really is a great guy. You know, people talk about that Terry Funk's one of the nicest guys in wrestling, and it always sounds like BS, but it's true. He really is one of the nicest guys.
Did he end up selling the ranch, by the way? I forgot.
Yes, he did.
Good. So he's got to be doing pretty well for himself right now.
Yeah, he called me. I don't know how much he got for that ranch. What I do know is that after he closed the sale, which I guess was in January of this year, he calls me and he goes, "Scotty, it's the weirdest thing. I'm homeless and I'm fucking rich." So I guess he did okay.
I think I remember reading someone describe it, you know, that Terry Funk does it, you know, because of whatever reasons that wrestlers do it, as opposed to the money, because someone just saying, "Have you seen his ranch?" Because I remember, you know, I've seen a little bit of the clips from, you know, the Beyond the Mat and, you know, the video that Bob Barnett tried to shoot at the barbecue there. That thing is just huge.
Yeah. Oh, man, it's monstrous. It was 110 acres. And I think he just got to the point where, you know, he and Vicky are in their 60s. It's just not – or no, Vicky might still be in her late 50s. I'm sorry, Vicky. I didn't mean to age you. But I think it just got to the point where, you know, they didn't have their daughters there anymore. And it was just too much work. They could have kept it up, but with just two people, that gets to be a lot of work in a hurry. And it just got to the point of diminishing returns, I think, for him.
That just happens. Like, my grandparents had this very nice piece of land where they were, but, you know, they're getting older. It's too much to maintain. So they sold it, and they moved into a smaller place. That just happens. Even if it's a huge, sprawling piece of land in Texas that's worth a hell of a lot of money, or even a little less. But,
yep.
Yeah. Now, Bill Watts, what was the process like with him, and did you also meet up with him through Dave?
No, I actually called Bill Watts out of the blue and told him who I was and told him what I was interested in doing. And he had been contacted by a couple of other guys about doing his life story, but he didn't want to do something that just glorified the wrestling business, and that was it. He wanted to do something that was reflective of his own spirituality, because that's a huge, huge part of his life. Mm-hmm. And I was the first one who was really of a mindset to want to do something with that. I think the other people who he had talked to had just wanted to do wrestling stories, and that wasn't really what I wanted to do. He did want to do the one chapter. There's one chapter in that book called, Keeping It Real, where he talks about maybe not just logic, but internal logic and the importance of the suspension of disbelief and how to keep things making sense in a way that doesn't insult your audience for following along with it, much of which is in direct defiance of what Vince McMahon is doing nowadays. Mm-hmm. And so he did want to do that, but his story, there's a lot more to it than just the wrestling aspect. And the wrestling business itself is something that really allowed him to channel a lot of negative feelings in his life. And so, he doesn't have the fondness for it that Terry does. And so that was something that made a difference in working with him. But, you know, in the end, it's his story. And you have to do what's going to serve that person the best to tell their story the way they want it told. You know, most people don't get a chance to do their life story in book form, and almost nobody gets a chance to have it done twice. And so, for someone who gets that opportunity, you know, it ought to be able to come out the way they want it to.
Now, did you just go right to ECW Press once you were together and had the idea for the religious slant on it, or did you go try some other publishers first and they didn't and they wanted just wrestling, or what?
Nope, I went straight to ECW, told them who I was talking to and kind of what I was doing, and then I was almost the middleman between the two of them until we got a deal put together, and then we were just kind of off and running.
Why are they so wrestling friendly?
I'm sorry?
Why is ECW Press so wrestling friendly?
The only reason that I can give you that makes any sense to me is that they've made a lot of money with those books. There's not a lot of overhead. They don't do a lot of slick extras, which isn't a knock against them. They just don't. They do attractive packaging. Most of their books, first editions are soft covers instead of hard covers. And, you know.
Except for the Russo book.
What's that?
Except for the Russo book.
Yeah, except for the Russo book. Although, actually, I don't know what the books who hit the shelves looked like, but the press copy that they sent me was a softback.
Remember, Brian Alvarez was very angry as a book collector that his book was soft cover and Russo's was hard cover.
Well, I don't know Russo, but I know Brian, and Brian wrote a much better book than Russo did, so he should just get over it.
And his is up. His got into several printings too. Pretty
oh
impressive.
Yeah, that boy, I would love to have one of mine sold as much as his did.
Do you think it was? Do you think that some of it sort of just like the name value, just of being the death of WCW, would help it as far as in stores, or do you think it just did so well via word of mouth online that really pushed it?
I think a lot of it was word of mouth, and you know he was able to promote it through his participation in the Observer site regularly. I mean, he was able to promote that thing every week.
Now, you said that you had some news about the paperback version of the ECW book that you did. Which, go ahead.
Yeah, I in fact just worked this out with Sports Publishing on Friday. Mm-hmm. And they're looking to put out a soft cover edition of Hardcore History, the Extremely Unauthorized Story of ECW. Mm-hmm. In the middle of next year. And what we're looking at doing is an additional chapter, which is probably going to run around 5,000 words, which would make it about an average-sized chapter if anybody has that book and has seen how big the other chapters are. This would probably be about an average-sized chapter, maybe a little bigger. And we're going to chronicle from the because where we leave off at the hardback is at the Hardcore Homecoming and the ECW One Night Stand pay-per-views of 2005. And so we'll pick up with this last chapter and have the story of this ECW relaunch, such as it is, that started in June and led to the show on Sci-Fi.
Sounds like fun. Did Sports Publishing approach you about the ECW book?
Or did called me and asked me what I thought about doing it. And this was just about a month after we'd gotten the Terry Funk taken care of. And I was up for doing it. I think the fact that I was not an ECW fan, I didn't have anything against it. I just wasn't one of the ECW hardcore faithfuls because I lived down here in Houston. We didn't have ECW. So I didn't have the emotional attachment to it that possibly somebody else who followed it would have.
I think that helped me because I was able to report on it without,
I mean, I went into it without an agenda. I didn't care about making anybody look good or making anybody look bad.
Now, I have to confess, I have not read this book, if only because John Lister sent me his, and I was ECW
now. Oh, mine's much better than his.
The DVD. Have you read his or the WWE books?
I only read a couple of chapters of the WWE book and started getting nauseous.
I heard it's basically the DVD.
And that's exactly what I thought.
Okay, and have you read John's at all?
Yeah, I did read his.
What did you think?
I thought it was good. I thought there was probably, I don't know. I mean, I hate to knock the way anybody else does anything. It's just the way he accumulated some of the information that he put out there. A lot of it came from, you know, shoot interviews and stuff that didn't require a lot of new and independent and original investigative work. You know what I mean? Yeah. I mean, what I did, I conducted probably, I've lost track. I conducted probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 interviews. About 10 of those are people who, for various reasons, asked not to be named. But I would say all but one or two of those were people whose names you would know, especially as an ECW follower.
I think John admitted as much that his was basically a chance to try to get a book that he wrote that a lot of people would read when the whole ECW mania started.
Yeah, and it's well written. So, you know, you certainly can't take anything away from him. It's put together very, very strongly.
I mean, I like that it was a concise history of ECW. It was, sometimes it seemed a little short, but he got everything that needed to be in there, and he just had a lot of, it was very detailed. I mean, your book, which I have not read, was more about first-hand stories and such, but I thought
there was another difference, too. I think that his tells you more story of the in front of the camera TV storylines that were going on. I did not feel the need to tell the complete on camera story of all these major TV storylines. I was more interested in the business in it of why it did what it did and those behind the scenes workings, you know, like there's a story in that book about a conversation between ECW and Vince McMahon about how they got Shane Douglas back after he went off and did the Dean Douglas gimmick in the WWF. And to my knowledge, it's a story that's never, ever appeared anywhere. And those were the kinds of things that I thought were important to put out there for what I was doing. To me, I wanted to tell the story of the company, not of the TV show. And I think I think that's the real distinction between our two books.
Okay. But not meant as a slide on John.
No, not at all. I mean, I think if someone really wanted to learn everything there was to learn about ECW, the best thing you could do would be to buy both of ours.
Yes. And I will be putting up Amazon links when I post this show. I'll even put up John's for comparison. I need to try to get John on this show, too, because he's a good guy and he's written some good stuff. And on that note, what other wrestling books have you read, lately or otherwise?
You know, I've almost tuned out of reading them for the same reason that I think the wrestling book market is suffering. There's a glut of wrestling books to the point, and you know, at some point, you reach a point where the hardcore fans who initially want to read everything, when you get to the point that they can't keep up with everything that's coming out, then too much stuff's being published. And although I like this book, the first time that it really hit me that we were probably going overboard with the wrestling books was when Lita's book came out. When Lita's story is important enough to tell that we got to put it in a hardback format, then too many people are getting books. And again, I enjoyed her book. I thought that there was some really good character sketches that you get from WWF people. And I think it was Meltzer who said this. You get a better sense of who Steve Austin is from Lita's book than you do from Steve Austin's book. And I think that's true. But by the same token, by the time Lita's book comes out, you're at least on the outset of a glut of the market. And that market is flooded if Harley Race puts out a book and nobody cares. And that's what happened.
I have to say, I did not hear the best reviews of the Harley Race book, saying it was too short and stuff.
I didn't either, but I almost think that's beside the point. I think it could have been brilliant wrestling book. and I don't think it would have sold real well. I mean, I think the glut of wrestling books, I definitely think it's hurt the books that I put out. There's just too much to choose from out there.
Now, is Terry Funk basically retired now, but unofficially so?
You know, I don't know if there will ever be a time when he will say, I'm putting my boots and my trunks up and I'm never taking them out again. But I do think the days of him looking for shots to do, I think those days are over.
Yeah, because this year, I don't think he's really done much aside from the ECW pay-per-view, has he?
No, that's the only thing he did. And the thing he told me before that show was that he thought it was probably going to be his last chance. It was really important to him that that be a good match. Mm-hmm. Because in his mind, it was the last chance people were going to have to see him on pay-per-view. Mm-hmm. Which to me says that he'll probably consider the occasional offer. But I think he's done as far as doing major matches. And, you know, that's where his interest was four months ago anyway.
Have people been calling him up to try to book him still, and has he been turning them down?
I can tell you for a fact that there's somebody calling him either this weekend or within the next week, and I don't know what his answer is going to be. So I can answer half of that. There's still some interest for him. It's just whether there's interest by him.
So for him, you know, he might do something special, like if it's the Wrestle Reunion shows or whatever, but otherwise he's not really going to.
Right, and I think even at shows like that, I think he's at the point where things need to be just right for him. You know, he's able to pick his shots to a greater extent than he perhaps ever was. Mm-hmm. Which is good because, you know, he doesn't have to be pressured to take a gig that's not going to be the best thing for him. He can really, really be picky.
Has he considered getting a new replacement at all? Or did he ever end up getting one after
the other? No, he never did. That image. He never did.
Has he considered it more lately now that he's somewhat retired?
Not that I know of.
My grandmother just got one, and I got to tell you, she loves it.
I will point that out. I'm due to be talking to him this week.
Okay. So I guess that's about it, unless you got anything to add, but I want to thank you for joining me today. This has been fun.
Well, thank you, sir. If anybody wants to see the pop culture column that I've started, they've put it online, and you can check it at www.galvnews.com, which is G-A-L-V as in Victor News, all one word, .com, and just scroll down until you get to lifestyle, and you'll find it. This week, the pop culture column expanded a little bit. Was doing a column on cover tunes, and the column itself is an interview with perhaps our finest cover artist, Richard Cheese.
Oh, that's right. You mentioned that, of Lounge Against the Machine.
Yes, who's without a doubt one of the funniest people on the face of this planet. And then as a sider to that, I put together my list of the 100 best cover versions of my lifetime.
Mm-hmm. That was basically your personal list?
Yes.
Okay, you know what? I am going to, as long as we have time, I am going to go look at that right now, because I didn't realize you were doing the list. I knew that you were doing the interview with Richard Cheese, but because I know you were doing something about cover versions, so I'm going to talk to you about this right now, because I'm curious what you picked. Okay, so I'm at galvnews.com, and lifestyle is... Okay, lifestyle, and then where do I go from there? Entertainment?
No, there's a lifestyle.
Click
lifestyle.
Okay, I didn't realize, because it gives you the menu from there. Okay. Everything old is new and cheesy again.
Yep, that's the column. There should be another thing right next to that, above or below, I don't know.
Songs you didn't know were covers. I don't see anything. It might be because I have my ad block turned on in Firefox. Unless, is it possible that they put it next, they put it in the listing in Lifestyles, or should it be with the column?
You know, I don't know if they put those two things together or not. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you that there's a Richard Cheese song at number 3.
Yeah, the top 100 list is not in there. Oh, I was curious. I wanted to talk to you about that.
I'll tell you my top 3. Number 3 was Richard Cheese covering Down With the Sickness by Disturbed. Number 2 was Dwight Yoakam's complete rearrangement of Train in Vain by The Clash. Mm-hmm. And number 1 is Stevie Wonder's cover of We Can Work It Out by The Beatles.
Okay. And Dwight Yoakam doing a... which Clash song did you just say? I forgot. Train in Vain. That sounds good.
It's actually really good. He completely... It even completely changes the melody. Mm-hmm. Changes the entire... So you wouldn't even recognize it unless you knew what you were listening to.
I'm not even finding it looking on Google News.
Huh.
Like, let me look up... Dwight Yoakam.
If... my little boy's on there playing Higglytown Heroes right now. But if I can get on the computer this evening, I'll email you the link for it.
Okay, I'll try to put it up then. Meanwhile, I'll link to the column. And... Dwight Yoakam training. And I'm trying Google News, and I'm sure this is fascinating listening for everyone, I'm sure. It's not showing up on Google News either, so I have no idea what's going on.
I don't know. I wish I knew what to tell you.
Yeah, go bug the website editor, I guess, for the paper. But meanwhile, I'll put a link up to your column, and also put up Amazon links for all three of your books. Well, four, including the ECW paperback, as that is on Amazon's website right now.
Thank you, sir. And I'm actually working on my first non-wrestling book right now. It's a story about a murder case from down here in Galveston.
Good times.
Pretty disturbing stuff.
Got a capsule version of it?
Is accused of strangling his parents and then living in the house with their remains for 9 months.
That sounds like fun.
I'm not recommending that for dinner time reading.
Certainly sounds like some interesting stuff, though. So let me know what the progress is with that. And I'd like to thank you for doing this. And the show will be back most likely Wednesday, joined by the former Craig Johnson of USWA and GWF, John Horton, who just made his return to wrestling last night as John Horton, doing commentary for the AWA Pinnacle show in Washington that he was producing.
Hey, ask those guys if they have any old copies of the Shin and Namaki post I can buy from them. That was the funniest thing.
That is certainly going to be on the list of things I'm going to ask them. I do have for next week, I have Stephen Prazak lined up as well.
Oh, good.
And I don't have the exact day yet. It's probably going to be Tuesday, but there might be a change. But that should be a lot of fun talking to both of those guys. And of course, if you scroll down a little on the... I think it should still be on the main page at davidbix.com. I do have a link to the issues of the Shin and Namaki post that John Horton posted online a few years ago.
Excellent.
I mentioned it in the Dave Prazak interview summary because we talked about that a little bit. And I guess that's about it. I have a couple other people I'm trying to line up. Possibly Brian Alvarez within the next week or so. That should be a lot of fun. And check out the message board on the website, trying to get it going, especially if you have any questions that I want to ask the guests, that you want me to ask the guests, that's the place to ask. As I post, whenever I have a guest confirmed for whenever, I post it there. So, got anything to ask me, then let me know, just in the forum. Got some other stuff set up yet, no one's really posting there yet, but please do so. And that's about it. I'd like to thank everyone for joining me, and I'd like to thank Scott, and that's it.
There she goes, she's on mission control.